newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's
the Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis on media issues of the week, and we are very grateful to have you join us. My name is Rex Smith. I'm editor-at-large of the Times Union, and we'll try to regulate the conversation as we go forward here with Dr. Alan Chartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio. Alan, I'm hoping that you're doing well out there in Massachusetts.
I'll do my best. I promise, Chief.
Well, we really appreciate your best and know that you give it your all the time. Rosemary Armeo is here, investigative journalist, professor. How are you, Rosemary?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Well, we're really glad that you're here. And Judy Patrick, vice president of the New York Press Association, longtime editor of the Daily Gazette in Schenectady, speaking to us from some northern area there in Washington County, right?
I am. It's a beautiful, cold day in the neighborhood today. Man.
Well, you know, we ought to start with a letter from one of our listeners, a professor in Massachusetts other than Alan Chartok, who writes, "Dear Rex, Alan, and colleagues, I am writing to ask that next week's Media Project panelists discuss the following issue. Why are our newspapers, newscasts, and social media ignoring the outrageous policies that our government is enacting while the public is distracted by the coronavirus? For instance, this week," she writes, "we see billions in public money flowing to America's richest corporations. Where is the oversight the Democrats promised? Other worrisome activities include Trump sending troops to the border, states suspending access to abortion. Trump would like the post office to go bankrupt before the November election and has threatened massive regulatory rollbacks, quote, to stimulate the economy. By supplying Americans primarily with stories about the pandemic," our listener writes, "journalists are failing in their mission of speaking truth to power. How can we get them to devote more attention to the corrupt, illegal, and immoral actions going on behind the scenes?"
You know, I always think, Rex, of the editor. Now, I've never been an editor. I was a publisher once of a very small newspaper. And the editor sits there and says, okay, in so many cases, not in all cases, you've pointed this out ad nauseum, you know, which will play well with the public? And everybody wants, there's a big fear on the parts of a lot of people that they're going to die as a result of catching this thing. So it's very hard to do justice to everything. The writer is absolutely correct that things that would have been at the top of the paper are not right now.
I was going to say, I think the writer is absolutely wrong. I'm surprised it came from a professor, in fact. How did she find out about each of those things that she said didn't get covered? Does she have some secret source in government? I read about every one of those things online or saw TV shows about them. Media is covering it. They do. It's easy to say that the media does not match our own perception of what's important. It happened today to me, Rex. I was reading a paper, you know, something about the Times Union, and there are three stories about anti-lockdown protests in Albany. I go, that's ridiculous. They didn't cover the Women's March that much. Now, you know, I don't think that's really true. I think the Times Union did cover the Women's March back in 2017, but I'm remembering it differently, and I resent seeing coverage of something I disagree with, and so it takes on added importance in my mind. And I think that's what the professor has done. She's sick of coverage, as we all are, of the virus, and she's saying, oh, give me some other stuff.
Yeah, I agree with Rosemary. I think there have been articles about all of the things she mentioned, about the bailout, about monitoring how that money is spent. But the bottom line is, on any given day, there's one story that's going to be of more interest and of more importance to people, and that's people dying of this virus. I mean, that is going to dominate the headlines, but it's not that those other things aren't being covered. They may not be being covered every night as the lead story on CNN or the CBS Evening News, but they're out there. People have to be wise consumers and search them out. They have to be active citizens. It's part of your job to find out all these things. Now, there are only so many journalists in the world, and there are a lot of stories to cover nowadays. I mean, there are stories that are not being covered. It's true, but that's the case on any day. There are a million stories out there in the world every day, and there's only so many people to cover them.
Well, what about the issue that Rosemary raises, the coronavirus protests? You know, this is a difficult thing to cover because there are these rallies, sometimes a few dozen people rallying, and, you know, you cover what is immediate, what is there, but the polling shows that the vast majority of the people believe that the lockdowns, we'll call them, or that the government's response has been appropriate, if anything, too limited. And so we believe that the protests are by a small minority. So that is the coverage out of proportion for what it is?
The big question on the small minority, Rex, is who's organizing this? Who's making this happen? I don't think it would be an extraordinary assumption that the Trump people somehow, who are trying to, quote, open up America again, until a poll comes and says people are rejecting what you're saying, and then he balls out his own governor, sycophant from Georgia, who is obviously following the Trump playbook, but he doesn't care about anybody else. The real story here, I hope some enterprising journalists will figure it out, is who is pushing the button that makes these people all of a sudden showing up all over the place? I happen to believe it's
the Washington Post has actually done that. The Washington Post has reported that some of the largest Facebook groups organizing these protests are run by a family of far-right pro-gun activists, the Doors, D-O-R-R. Ben Doerr is the political director of a gun rights group in Minnesota. He's got a couple of brothers. And these Facebook groups have been really a source of misinformation about the coronavirus. And it's connected also to the Michigan Freedom Fund, which is headed by the husband of Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos.
The Michigan governor has also come out and talked about the unhappy organizers of this. I think the problem for local papers is you've got several hundred people. I think that's the way the paper described it today. And the Capitol steps in Albany, clogging the streets are the phrases. So it sounds really big without having, I don't have a really good idea. They're more or less than we're at the Women's March, as one example, my example from before. I don't know. And I think it is important to get their voices in the paper, even though I heartily disagree with them and think they're incredibly stupid. I do want to hear what they have to say, and they have a right to have their voices heard. That's a dilemma for local reporters.
Yeah, but it's a matter of proportionality. I mean, in other words, if it's a small group, and I always think that the smaller the group, the bigger the American flag. If it's a small group, somehow it's the media's responsibility to say what it is.
You know, and there's also a story there that a local paper covering this could do is talk to as many people as they can and say, what do you do for a living? Tell me exactly how this affects you and how you found out about this. Because I think there might be a more interesting story there than just, oh, I'm against this because I think the economy should open back up and get the governor's reaction. I mean, that's a simple tit-for-tat kind of story. But a real story, finding out, you know, where are these people coming from? How did they know about it and what their real motivations are? Again, if you do it for this, but you also have to do it for the Women's March. Do it for any kind of protest you do, because I mean, that's the fair way to approach it.
I think that in modern times, the media is having a hard time figuring out how to cover both the president who lies openly and repeatedly. How do you act respectfully, as we always have, and cover him? And the same with protests. Protests are different now than in the 60s. Just people coming together in the streets is not as difficult to organize. It happens, we saw, with these protests quickly and efficiently. So how do you cover? How do you get at the real meaning of those protests and the underlying dissent? It's hard.
In Albany, the state capital, I've often had to tell people who called me to complain about our lack of coverage of an event that it's not hard to get a couple hundred people together for a rally. It happens all the time.
Right.
Getting thousands is a bigger deal, and that you give a lot of attention to. But I remember when the Tea Party first took off, being quite surprised in 2009 to see the number of people who turned out. I thought this was really generated by local talk radio. And then there was a lot of support for these Tea Party movements, as it came to be called, from Fox News. And the same thing is happening now. Fox News gives a lot of time on the air to these rallies all over the country. So do other cable outlets. They're paying a lot of attention to rallies that are just a few hundred people. But it is hard to make judgments about these things. What's really a grassroots movement or what is, you know, what we call astroturf, a simulation of grassroots action that isn't real? How much of it is generated by these political motives? And do you cover it less if it's organized, if there are political forces behind it, or do you still cover it? It still represents people's feelings, right?
And also, isn't it a matter of geography? So, for example, I remember my PhD advisor, you know, had a bee in her bonnet about taking away mental health funds in New York City. So the two of us made giant oak tag things and went out in front of City Hall and held them up. I have that proudly on my wall here, and it meant absolutely nothing. Now, if you did it in Washington County, maybe you get a little press.
Right. You know, I'm remembering a Bay Area TV station some years ago on a nice spring day did a story asking for readers' opinions. They had this feature about readers call in and give your views, readers' opinions about the issue of retransigence. And they give you a capsule about what retransigence is, that many Democrats support retransigence, but Republicans say, and they had a lot of people who called in. They gave at the end of the newscast the support or lack of support for the issue of retransigence. And of course, there is no such thing. The word is made up, retransigence. It sounds really good, but it's not real. It was April the 1st. It was an April Fool's joke by the TV station.
Wow.
But people were very willing to step forward and offer their opinions. It sounds like the same sort of thing you did with oak tag signs, Alan, their opinions on something that was absolutely false. We're easily swayed.
In the case of Dr. Padilla, it wasn't false at all. It was that they were taking money away from mental health, and she wanted more money. And so she said, make a sign. And there she was in charge of my PhD, and I did what I was told, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You know, on these protests, if you look at the photographs from many of them, you'll see a lot of conspiracy theories, a lot of gun rights activism. And as you write that, I think if you do find out that it's being motivated by a political party or some of the political agenda, you just need to state that. I mean, everybody has a right to their own political agenda. But as long as you flush out the story as much as you can and not make it a simple, we need to reopen the economy, because there's a lot more going on there than just that.
Yeah, yes. One other thing to add to that, Judy, is that it doesn't come out in one day. If you read the paper Wednesday, for example, and say, oh, there's nothing in the paper about this, that doesn't mean it isn't going to be there Friday, Saturday, or next Wednesday as the stories develop. And we're seeing now that the reasons for these protests is becoming extremely clear. Another 4.5 million people filed for unemployment. We're up to 26 million people out of jobs in the United States. There's a big story in the New York Times about coming food shortages around the world. People are afraid, and there is economic problems rising enormously. So is it really so surprising? Maybe my former line that it's hard not to give people their voices wrong. Maybe it's easy to explain what's going on. It just takes us a little time to get at the whole story.
I think that's a really good point. People may not see something one day that may have been there another. Of course, if the answer is to subscribe to your local newspaper and read it every day.
Uh-huh. But notice how I slipped in that little commercial plug.
Excellent.
There. It's true.
Excellent. Thank you.
No, it's true, though.
But isn't it incredible that this is probably, I don't know about you, Rosemary, but I'm an old, really old guy. I think this is the worst crisis that in my 78 years I have ever seen. I don't think there's ever anything like it. I heard about the Depression. I didn't really witness it. My parents did. But in our lifetimes, this is a huge story. The potential of people dying and the worst president that the United States has ever had at the helm. It's a hell of a story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it deserves to get the prominent and the most of the majority of the coverage of the media. I have no quarrel with that.
Right. There's a trend that seems to be going on now, a trend of trying to do good news. There are efforts to do, there's actually a newsletter that Mother Jones does called Recharge. The Washington Post has one called The Optimist. There's even a little news network done by the actor John Krasinski, who did The Office. He actually has a thing where he sits at a desk and does some good news. Is this delusional, or is this actually something that's good to give people a break?
And not only that, but CNN, which a lot of people watch, does it regularly. Theirs is called Heroes, and somebody who deserves a special call out for what they're doing. I don't see anything wrong with it. Does anybody else?
I've looked at good news forever because I don't like it, and I hate having to write it. I used to turn down doing dog stories from the editors who wanted good news in the paper.
Oh, what a grouch.
You know, they were like formulaic and so forced. But if there's a really good feature story and you have a great writer, a Paul Grandel or a Pat Lackey that I used to work with, a great feature writer who turns it into a wonderful little piece of good news in a sea of famine, disaster, and plague, then that is much respected and loved by our readers. It's when we try to put a false hope into a story that really is all gloom and doom. Like, how do you put a little happy turn in a story about a plague that's killing thousands right now and will go up to millions, maybe? How do you put a happy sign in it? Well, look to the future for what happens next. It's artificial. So I'm glad that they're segregating the happy news. And I do think people seek it out the same way we look at musicals and watch movies and go on Netflix. It's escaping from reality.
Yeah, Judy, you have no doubt, as an editor, assigned dog stories. Rosemary would have...
dog stories. Oh.
You know, what I'm seeing are there are snippets of kindness and generosity happening throughout every community. You know, good things are happening, but there are also a lot of nasty things happening. People are, you know, taking toilet paper away from people. They're fighting over paper towels and stores. That happens. But there are also moments of generosity, and that is part of the story. But what I agree with Rosemary, there's a place for it, but it's not the story. We do the stories about the people who have died because of COVID-19. Those are really important things to do, and they're often heartwarming, and they need to be done. But I think there is a danger of shifting the balance too much on the side of really good news, because this is not a good time for the world. There are moments, there's glimmers of happiness, of hope, of generosity, and we need to document that. But I do not think that needs to be the dominant focus of our attention. There's room for all kinds of stories in the paper or on television or on the radio.
The nature of news, I've often had to explain to people who call me and say, you know, you always write about bad news in the newspaper. Why is the newspaper filled with bad news? And the fact is, news is in part just at whatever is a departure from the norm. And fortunately, most of us lead lives that are stable and good. And so when things go wrong, when there's a homicide or a terrible accident, you write about it. You know, 150 planes take off and land every day at the Albany International Airport. And we don't write about them, but if one flight belly flops, we are sure as hell going to write about it. So that is, you know, part of what news is.
Well, Rex, you know, we've said that to readers for decades, and that's not even true, because newspapers and radio shows and all kinds of news are filled with happy stories. Little kids learning, a new way to teach, a successful award, graduation. Our news is filled with good stuff, but it's not memorable. What is memorable is a sensational murder, an outrageous plague. Those are things that stick in your mind, and it just blocks out all the preponderance of good news, which really is. Especially in our community news, which I did for many years.
You know, if it's possible, I'd love to talk about Governor Cuomo and his preemption of the airwaves. You know, he's on 3-4 times a day now, including a weekly sort of half an hour he does with me, which I still can't figure out why he's being so generous, but he does. So he has become, and the news media has made him, let's face it, if you take a look at CNN, you get the President of the United States on at 5 o'clock, but they have made a unilateral decision that one governor is going to be on every single day. What do you think about that?
Well, he's on because he's the governor of the state at the epicenter of this pandemic. And I think, and he's compelling. He has proved day after day that he can provide a compelling presentation of what's happening, provide the facts, and the viewers have come to him. And I think he's been effective in corralling the federal government to work in my state's favor, which I'm very happy about. Is he doing too much? Is he not spending enough time focusing on actually getting the job done here in New York? I think at this point in time, being out there has become an integral part of his job.
You know, Judy, I couldn't agree with you more. Look, there's a moment in people's lives. I keep thinking about FDR and the fireside chats. It was a very rudimentary concept of how you get through to people, but he used the radio effectively. And I also think it takes a lot of guts for CNN to say, okay, we're going to do the governor of New York, but not the governor of California. Oh, occasionally we'll have him on. But this daily briefing, I think it's wonderful, and I agree with you.
There are a couple of factors, of course. New York is the epicenter of the media universe. Networks have their headquarters, most of them in New York. The majority of journalists are based in New York, so it makes it more their focus. And I think, too, that the notion is that if you're a network news executive, you're looking for something that can be counter-programming to the White House briefing and to what is, frankly, misinformation coming out of the White House. And so Andrew Cuomo provides a compelling counterpoint that gives them an opportunity to do that. And he's available. He's shrewdly used the media focus on New York and the desire for something other than Donald Trump's show. I think Governor Cuomo has shrewdly used this to project himself out there. You know, there is not a rationale for putting Joe Biden in front of the cameras. He's sitting in his basement in Delaware, and you can't put him out there. So who are you going to put out there who might be somebody other than Donald Trump?
Well, first of all, you're right. But if the CNN people had made a point, say, okay, Mr. Vice President, we want you on every single day for an hour or two in the morning, and his staff got together and they came up with things for him to talk about and they prepared him and the rest of it, it could work, but they have not chosen that because Cuomo is far more dynamic.
Well, Cuomo has a responsibility. Joe Biden is not the president. He doesn't have a job to do now. And Andrew Cuomo is talking about his responsibility as the governor of the state, where is the epicenter of the illness. So he actually has a rationale for being in front of the cameras and talking to his constituents. Joe Biden currently has no constituents.
I think
the networks would be making a political play if they were doing that, whereas this is covering a public official.
Listen, Rex, just for the hell of it, let me argue with you. And that is, Joe Biden is going to be the candidate who is going to run for president of the United States. That gives him a huge constituency. Now, from Biden's point of view, his numbers keep going up. The president is on every day, and he's being savaged by the media and everybody else for what he's doing, and his numbers keep going down. So, you know, just take that for what it's worth.
Hey, and at this point, the White House press briefings are essentially campaign rallies, so maybe it would be fair to give Biden his own little campaign rally at some point, even though he doesn't have the scientists as, you know, backup singers.
He could.
If he's looking at the polls, maybe he's just thinking, let Trump just keep talking because he isn't helping himself. Biden.
Absolutely right.
What about the folks who sometimes say, you know, I need to take a little break from the media? Actually, it's interesting. NPR has a new public editor, Kelly McBride, from the Poynter Institute down in Florida, who's been one of the leading voices on journalism ethics for the last four decades. That might be a little exaggeration, three decades maybe. But Kelly McBride now, the public editor, has said that listening to the news, as she's listening to a lot of NPR these days, is harder than she thought because there is so much going on. And especially in this crisis, it's very hard to keep listening to it all. What do you think about people who say, you know, I just need to take a break?
There are a lot of people.
Don't we all do it?
Yeah, I live with a woman who says, get him out of here when the president comes on. And I think a lot of people do. On the other hand, it is an extraordinary moment in our history when it's compelling. And there are a lot of people who like to watch the president at 5 o'clock at night make a fool of himself and say, well, he shouldn't have said that. And it happens almost every day.
Every time I take a break, I go, shoot, I missed something. You know, I'm always worried that I'm going to miss some major breakthrough. And so that's always a worry for me. But I am trying to break away.
But you're a newsie, right?
I do it every once in a while. I'm a newsie, too. I just will break away for no more than two nights, but no news at all. I watch junk TV. Fabulous.
Me too. Which programs do you watch again, Rosemary?
I like Gunsmoke. How about you, Alan?
No, I not only watch Gunsmoke, but
it always wins.
Yes, exactly. Not the early ones. The early ones, the good guys sometimes lost, but the older Technicolor ones.
Here we go.
Yeah. But I got to tell you, I think Gunsmoke is fine, and I don't watch anything more than three or four times.
You draw the line there, absolutely. By the way, just speaking of NPR, this is a cool thing. The new head of news for she's been there for about 2 years now, Nancy Barnes, plans to double the number of investigative reporters in the NPR newsroom by this summer. Since we have a lot of NPR listeners, obviously, since we are on public radio here, that is very interesting. With the government handing out trillions of dollars and healthcare workers not able to get protective equipment and so on, so this is a bit of good timing, isn't it? A little bit of good news in the journalism world.
Well, Rex, for whatever it's worth, we got a letter at WAMC, as did the head of all of these stations. And one of the things that they're saying is, oh, woe is us. We have no money. We're running out of money. The people who are buying underwriting on NPR are not really there the same way they were. And everybody's seeing that. We're seeing some of it, although our listenership has gone up. No two ways about it. And the amount of money that we're getting in the mail from the wonderful people who support the station is incredible. I mean, incredible. Every day I get a report on it, and compared to last year at this time, it's extraordinary. So people will vote with their pocketbooks to some degree.
Well, that's wonderful news. We ought to leave on that positive note, because there is plenty of bad news around us and bad news in the journalism world as well. So that would be about it for this week's Media Project. I'm Rex Smith with Alan Chartok and Judy Patrick and Rosemary Armeo, and we thank you for joining us this week on the Media Project.
Remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery? She wanted money to buy a new fur coat.
The Media Project is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Alan Chartok is CEO of WAMC, professor emeritus at the State University of New York, commentator, columnist, and author. Rex Smith is editor-at-large of the Times Union. Judy Patrick is the vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association. And Rosemary Armeo is an investigative journalist and former chair of the Department of Journalism at the University at Albany. You can listen to or podcast The Media Project anytime at WAMC.org or just download the WAMC app for your iPhone or Android at the Play Store today. Thanks for listening.
The richest girl who could not bake a cake. Ding-a-ling, 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 ding. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild. Got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill. All together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy's an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now, publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give 3 cheers for freedom of the press.